to the Archive Room podcast. First of May, I'm Judith Lay, and I'm very pleased to find you waiting for me at the door to the Archive Room, the place where we keep stories of island life in years gone by, told by the people who were there. So come on in, sit down and make yourself comfortable, and let's listen to this week's selection. This week, as part of our special programming to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the foundation of the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, we're looking back on the life of the man who started it all in a tavern in London on the 4th of March 1824. And we're doing this by eavesdropping on a conversation recorded 40 years ago between Robert Kelly, at that time editor of the Isle of Man Times, who wrote a book about the life of Sir William Hillary, appropriately titled For Those in Peril, and Ian Cottier. Being a keen sailor himself, Ian well understands the immense value of the RNLI, both then and now. The statue of Sir William on Douglas Head forever looks out towards the landmark Tower of Refuge, and Sir William is buried in St George's Churchyard, here in the heart of Douglas. But he wasn't a Manxman. He was born into a Quaker family in Yorkshire.
How did he come to be in the Isle of Man in the first place, and when did he arrive?
He arrived to live here in 1808. However, there are suggestions that he may have visited the island in the earlier 1800s as a skipper of one of the vessels plying between Liverpool and Douglas, operated by the Drinkwater family of Kirby.
Well, if he was a skipper of a vessel, this doesn't really sound a very titled background. He became Sir William later on, I suppose, then.
Yes, he was born as a Quaker to a small farming family in the Dales of Yorkshire. However, he received a sophisticated education which led him to London and high society, very much alien to a Quaker background.
There's also some idea of an emotional entanglement.
Sir William, having mixed in high society, which included one of the princes to whom he became equerry, eventually eloped with an heiress from Danbury in Essex, much against the wishes of her guardian.
Did they in fact elope to the Isle of Man?
No, they just eloped and set up home in England at that time. And he was eventually accepted by the family and based himself at a mansion with very large grounds called Danbury Place. The Napoleonic Wars were upon them at the time, and there were real fears that a Napoleonic army was about to invade. Some of the rich landed gentry raised their own militia, and William at that time squandered most of the family money on his own private army, which became known as the Essex Legion.
So how then did he come to the Isle of Man?
After a few years, and most of the wealth dissipated, his marriage was virtually on the rocks because of dissipating the wealth, and he had to find somewhere else to go. I suppose it was a natural thing for him to think of the Isle of Man, because the Isle of Man had a strange law at that time which said that people could not be sued within the Isle of Man for debts contracted outside the island. Therefore, the island was a debtor's haven at that time. Therefore, we got the situation that, having squandered the family money, not entirely but mostly, the marriage on the rocks, he had to look for somewhere to go. He moves to the Isle of Man, but not before receiving a baronetcy from the king in recognition of all that he had done.
So he squandered the family wealth on the defence of the realm, so to speak, and got a baronetcy in exchange for it.
Yes. So in 1808, arriving on the Isle of Man as Sir William, he integrated, apparently quite nicely, moving into a house at the top of Prospect Hill. At that time, that was the periphery of Douglas and was very much a country area with orchards around it. It was from there that he would see incidents in Douglas Bay involving shipwreck. He then met a local girl called Emma Tobin from the Middle Farm.
So he lived the rest of his life in Douglas and is buried in St George's Churchyard?
Yes, with two women at his side, neither of them his first wife. One of them he married twice. there was a great fear that an illustrious reputation could be damaged by such words as bigamy. However, it wasn't necessarily the case. Sir William met a local girl in the Isle of Man, Emma Tobin, after fleeing here from his creditors. He was still married to the heiress in Danbury. He'd had twins to his first wife, a boy and a girl. Having met Emma, he eloped again, this time to Whitehaven by fishing boat and from there to Gretna Green, and went through another marriage service. Now, lots of people have presumed that this was bigamy, but it's questionable whether it was. He was married in London in a Church of England ceremony. He went to Scotland and prior to his marriage there, undertook a divorce Scottish style, which was not recognised in England, and then went through a Scottish marriage service. On returning to the Isle of Man, he published notice of his marriage in English papers and Manx papers, so there was no secrecy about it, and lived here without any prosecution because there was no written law in the Isle of Man at the time against bigamy.
Now, that gives us two elopements then, one with the heiress in Danbury and one with Miss Tobin from Douglas, but he's actually buried in St George's Churchyard with two women by his side, neither of which is his first wife.
Yes. The other woman was a Sarah St John. He met her in Lower Douglas, got involved with her, and although there are no records to what extent his involvement reached, she was certainly invited to live with himself, Emma Tobin, at Prospect Hill. He eventually passed his entire wealth, whatever it was, to her in her name as trustee on his behalf and Emma's behalf. It was the law in the Isle of Man at the time that people could do that to protect themselves from possible raiding parties from England who came to try and kidnap people who were owed money in England and couldn't be sued for debt in the Isle of Man. Throughout the remainder of his life, Sarah St. John handled all his finances, and actually it was through Sarah St. John that all finances flowed for anything to do with the lifeboat movement on the Isle of Man.
And, of course, the building of the Tower of Refuge as
well. Yes, everything was done through her.
You said that he married one of these women twice.
Yes, that's Emma Tobin, Lady Hillary. After the death of his first wife in Danbury in about 1830, he decided to legitimise his marriage to Emma Tobin in case there was any question about her status, and quite secretly went to Kirkbraddon with the Attorney General and a couple of other close friends and went through a second marriage.
Hillary at this time would be about 60, of course.
Yes.
Were there any children of this second marriage?
None.
Human flaws may be, but for everyone who has ever heard of him, Hillary's greatest achievement was the establishment of the Royal National Lifeboat Institution.
Let's now turn, Robert, to the foundation of the RNLI. How did he come to be interested in this particular aspect of national life?
Well, when he arrived on the Isle of Man, there was a small lifeboat, rather like a rowing boat, that was donated to the local community by the Duke of Atholl, the then Lord of Man. These sort of lifeboats were donated to the seafaring communities at the time by members of the Humane Society or through the Lloyd's insurance underwriters. However, there was no organising body. It was up to the humanity of local individuals to operate these lifeboats. Sir William took this concept to heart, and every time he saw a ship in distress in Douglas Bay, he raced down to the harbour, and on many occasions, in torrential rain and getting soaked despite his advancing years, he'd be offering what little money he had to people to go with him on these small boats out into the bay, despite whatever conditions existed, to save the stricken crews.
But this was all on a rather unofficial basis, I suppose. It was the wreck of the racehorse, really, that brought Hillary's mind into focus on the need for a national organisation.
Yes, there was a number of wrecks. There were 14 vessels saved at one stage in Douglas Bay. Then the Vigilant, a frigate, was wrecked in Douglas Bay, and the Racehorse came as another naval vessel, came to salvage the remnants of the Vigilant, but mistook the lights of Castletown for Douglas and went aground at Langness. Various rescue parties from Castletown rescued members of the crew, but several were lost. And Sir William thought that there should be some organising body to compensate the widows and orphans for their loss of maintenance in their future years.
He actually approached the Admiralty then to establish such a body, to make it a kind of crown organisation, didn't he?
Yes, and they said it was up to the people themselves to do it. It was not something for officialdom to get involved in.
And, of course, this produced the great self-help tradition, which is the RNLI today.
Yes. In 1824, he published pamphlets addressed to the community, calling upon the community at large to set up a body which could organise all these lifeboat undertakings throughout the country.
And this culminated in a public meeting in February of 1824.
Yes. At which people like William Wilberforce were present, which was a curious anomaly in view of Sir William's earlier association with slave trading in the Caribbean, which he had since ceased to be associated with because his brother had died and he'd inherited and sold the plantation.
And the outcome of all this was the RNLI being established. How did things progress from there, and how was Hillary involved?
Hillary came back to the Isle of Man and set up a branch on the island in Douglas.
Hillary was also greatly interested in lifeboat design, wasn't he? I suppose the first lifeboats are fairly rudimentary affairs.
Yes, rather like overgrown rowing boats. The first one supplied by the institution was about 24 foot long with 8 double banked oars and some cork to provide buoyancy. Sir William, however, was campaigning even then for a fleet of lifeboats powered by steam engines and paddle wheels.
So he was well ahead of his time. In fact, there were pulling and sailing lifeboats in use well into the 1930s, weren't there, 100 years later?
Yes.
How had Hillary become an innovator in this kind of way?
He always seemed to be far-seeing in everything that he wrote. He anticipated, for example, nothing to do with the lifeboat movement, but problems with Palestine as it exists today, and wanted the British Crown to give Palestine over to the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem to run, to prevent it developing into the situation that has happened today.
So, a man of very great vision, in fact.
Well, yes, in that connection, he forecast the build-up of America to be one of the biggest maritime nations in the world, and he was envisaging a major war between Britain and America and was calling upon the British to build up a massive naval fleet to fight the Americans.
Was he really a humanitarian?
Oh, yes, very much so. He cared for the individual to the point that he would give money to assist in all kinds of causes on the island. And although he died penniless because of a local bank collapse and speculative deals he'd been doing through the bank, at his funeral, it's reported that his cortege was followed by thousands of people.
The great man followed to his tomb by a host of admirers. But he was not only a man of ideas. He was also a man of action and of great personal courage.
In the archive room this week, we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of the foundation of the RNLI by listening to a conversation recorded 40 years ago between keen sailor Ian Cottier and Robert Kelly, author of the book For Those in Peril, telling the full and fascinating story of Sir William Hillary, the man who had a vision for a service dedicated to saving lives at sea.
The number of shipwrecks that occurred in Douglas Bay were considerable during that century, principally because of the rock in the middle where there is now the Tower Refuge. It was called St. Mary's Isle. And numerous vessels were either forced by inshore gales or dragged their anchor and went onto that rock. And it was from those rocks that he was responsible for saving most of the people he's credited with saving.
If we go to the Manx Museum, there's a painting of the wreck of the St. George, which was one of Hillary's greater moments.
Yes, in the battle between the Isle of Man Steam Packet Company and a rival company, the St. George was the flagship of the rival company, and in one of its famous races with one of the Manx Steam Packet vessels, it was wrecked on the St. Mary's Isle. He was responsible for saving many of the crew at great risk to himself because he never could swim himself, and he was swept overboard from his lifeboat, had ribs crushed, and was only dragged half senseless aboard again by another member of the crew.
No life was lost on that occasion?
None were lost. He saved everybody. Like so many vessels before her, she was driven straight onto St. Mary's Isle and was threatened with being totally broken up with the pounding of the waves. Sir William, like before, got his crew together, and whilst others were getting other crews together with several other vessels, he set sail into the gale, oblivious to his own danger, and encountered many problems of trying to get the men off. There were 22 on board, and he had 14 on his lifeboat. The storm was too strong for him to approach from the seaward side of the vessel, so there was only one way he could approach, and that was to manoeuvre his lifeboat with oars in a heavy sea into calm water, which existed between the wreck and the rocks. There was a gap of water between the two, and so he had to manoeuvre the vessel in between the vessel and the rocks. This he did. But having got there, they found they couldn't get out because rigging and various other parts of the St. George came collapsing down in front of them. So the lifeboat men ended up on board the St. George, trapped too. In the end, they spent 2 hours cutting away all the rigging and getting all the crew and lifeboat men together and planning how to get away once they'd got the obstructions clear. They eventually got those obstructions clear and endeavoured to pull out into the sea, open sea again. They were caught by a big wave, and providentially, it swept them right over the rocks to the other side into sheltered water. But for that, they probably would have been lost. From there, they were able to row to shore.
So at what stage, then, did Hillary go overboard? Was it on the approach or in this latter stage?
In the original approach, when they were manoeuvring, he was swept overboard. A rope was hanging over the side of the St. George. He grabbed hold of that, and then he felt some arms just come down and reach for him and pull him aboard. So in all these decisions about how to extricate themselves from the St. George, he was lying injured on the deck of the St. George with his broken ribs.
Broken ribs or not, a veritable man of action. And bear in mind, by 1830, Hillary was in his 60th year. No age, you would think, for going out in gale conditions in an open lifeboat. Yet that's the man he was.
It was as a result of that shipwreck that he decided that something should be done about the isle and launched an appeal, to which he contributed generously himself, for the building of the tower that exists there now. The idea being that there should be a bell on it which shipwrecked mariners could ring to raise the alarm, and some foodstuffs stashed away in it above sea level so that they could eat and drink. And throughout his life he was campaigning for a gigantic asylum harbour to be created for shipping in the Irish Sea, and his proposal was for a pier to be extended from Douglas Head right out to St. Mary's Isle. And at one stage he tried to demonstrate it by getting fishing vessels to line all up in a line, but they were dispersed by a gale.
Thanks to Robert Kelly's researches, we've heard what a fascinating, multifaceted character Sir William Hillary really was. In his 60th year, he directed the rescue of the crew of the St. George, wrecked on Conister Rock in Douglas Bay. Robert Kelly brings the story to a close, beginning with Hillary's undiminished taste for financial speculation.
On the death of his first wife, he then had some funds, having sold up what remained of the Danbury estate. This he used to buy a mansion at that time, Fort Anne, on Douglas Head. But he also had to take out a heavy mortgage, which valued the property well in excess of its true value. That didn't matter at the time because he had an income from investments. However, Sir William proceeded to embark on various land speculation deals to create a new town in what is now Upper Douglas in the effort to make a lot more money. The island at that time was at the peak of a new resident boom. His first idea was a tontine, in which various people participated in a scheme where they bought the land and the last person to survive inherited the lot. There weren't any takers on it, unfortunately, so he got a few trustees acting on his behalf to launch a public lottery through a local bank. Unfortunately, the local bank crashed. The trustees were associated with the bank, and they welched on his agreement and took all his land and assets down with the bank, leaving him penniless. His property was seized eventually, but not without a lot of court action, because it emerged that he'd used Sarah St. John as the name, as owner of the property. And so the receivers had to wait until such time as Sarah St. John died of old age before they could seize Fort Anne and make Sir William homeless. Subsequently, he had to move in old age and suffering badly from rheumatism to Athol Street and then to a property called Woodville in Upper Douglas, and it was there that he died in 1845.
There is a rather macabre touch to his death as well, isn't there?
Yes, it has been suggested that because he died owing so much money, his creditors regarded his corpse as an asset of his estate and tried to steal it to sell to vivisectionists or doctors who wanted to explore the anatomy of such a man. Certainly his coffin was moved within the vault at some stage because builders entered the vault and found it lying on the floor.
But finally, the story ends on a very much more creditable note, Robert, doesn't it?
Yes, although his vault was unmarked for many, many years because of the debts he left behind him, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution in 1924 decided that it was about time that they recognised their founder and had the vault cleaned, restored, railings put around it, and a commemorative tablet set into its wall.
Just remind us, finally, what the last lines of that commemorative tablet are.
It says, "Fearless himself in the work of rescue from shipwreck, he helped to save 305 lives and was 3 times awarded the gold medal of the institution for great gallantry. What his wisdom planned and power enforced, more potent still his great example showed."
A fascinating character right to the end of his life, and Sir William Hillary and the work of the RNLI continue to impress and inspire. Well-known local shanty singers, Mine's a Shanty, have a new song in their repertoire, written specially for the bicentenary. It'll be launched at an RNLI fundraising concert, but we've been allowed a sneak preview of just one verse.
"For centuries sailors crossed the seas, the winds and waves are braving. Should Davy Jones come calling, though no man thought them worth saving. Then in 1822 the racehorse she was grounded, and from that tragic loss of men the lifeboats they were founded.
Sing RNL and I, an institution who, with no pay, fame or glory, still risk their lives for you."
Words, music and singing by our very own Mine's a Shanty. In the archive room this week, you heard Robert Kelly, author of For Those in Peril, The Life Story of Sir William Hillary, talking with lifelong sailor Ian Cottier, part of our special series of programmes here on Manx Radio, celebrating the 200th anniversary of the foundation of the Royal National Lifeboat Institution by Sir William. And that's where we must leave the archive room for another week. So let's turn off the lights and close the door. And what stories will we be sharing next week? I hope you'll join me again to find out. I'm Judith Lay, saying thank you for listening and wishing you a very good evening.
The sound of your life. Manx Radio.